Jones here now, who's the author of the 42A report. She's also a professor of rebuttal, so she'll be here to answer questions after reading her summary. But just quickly, coming back to the issue of access for emergency vehicles, she pointed out that that hadn't made it into the rebuttal version of the matters of discretion, but at provision 29.8.5, which are the assessment criteria.
I heard Ms. Jones say it might be in the assessment method, so I had a quick look.
That's right. So her view is that it more appropriately fits as, as an assessment criteria rather than a matter of discretion, and so that's where it now sits.
Thank you.
Okay, my evidence assesses and makes recommendations in relation to the submissions on Chapter 29 and related variations to Chapters 2, Definitions, 37, which is Designations, 21, Rural, 12, Queenstown Town Centre, and 9, High Density Residential. I consider the rebuttal Chapter 29 provisions and varied chapters are the most appropriate way of managing the transport-related effects of land use and subdivision. Chapter 29 seeks to achieve an integrated, safe and efficient transport network that provides for all transport modes, reduces dependency on private motor vehicles, and promotes the use of shared, public and active transport. In response to both submissions and evidence, I've recommended certain amendments to Chapter 29, including exempting HGTAs from the minimum parking requirements, which will remove the need for HGTAs to obtain consent for breaching the minimum parking requirements, and clarify that meeting the minimum parking requirements will not necessarily result in the most appropriate outcome in relation to larger developments. Exempting activities from the HGTA rule where an integrated transport assessment exists and mitigation measures are already committed to, which I consider will improve certainty and administrative efficiency. Lowering the MPRs in some additional zones and for some specific activities, which will enable more efficient land use and reduction in car dominance. Narrowing the extent to which the code of practice is incorporated into the PDP. Reducing the requirements for end-of-trip facilities, cycle parking and e-bicycle charging facilities, enabling more efficient development while still requiring some provision. And providing specifically for coach parking in some zones, enabling such facilities to be established more readily, thereby encouraging coach travel and providing an alternative to visitor accommodation, providing such parks on site. The key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and those submitters who have filed evidence are that the HTGA rule should remain, and in particular should continue to apply in the Jack's Point zone and Airport zone, noting that it is not simply duplicating assessments that were undertaken at the zoning stage. The threshold for residential units should remain at 50 units and not be raised to 100 units. Rental vehicle activity rules should continue to apply to the airport zone, and the MPRs for guest room type VA visitor accommodation should not be reduced other than in the high density residential, medium density residential between suburban park streets and the mixed business use zones. Further to the above, I also wish to point out that in my correction to paragraph 12.4 of my rebuttal evidence is that the largest area of local shopping centre zone land is approximately 2.9 hectares, not 2 hectares as initially stated.
Just before we take questions, Ms. Jones does have a few corrections that she's identified for her evidence to our report and rebuttal. Do you want us to work through those now, or would it be easier if we just, I think it's about half a dozen, but we could always email them to Hope for circulation to the panel.
If there's half a dozen, it's probably easier to email them than for us to try and go through them.
we'll circulate that email to Hope this afternoon.
Okay. Thank you. Can I just, detailed question, Ms. Jones. In that last paragraph 4, you talked about medium density residential between suburban park streets in Queenstown, and you've mentioned that in other places. I can understand the provision adopted before the decision, but most of that land that's
pending to...
Has the land on Suburb Street itself been rezoned?
Yes. Well, not on the eastern side.
No.
But on the western side.
Okay,
all of the land from Suburb through to Hobart has been rezoned by the state.
Right, so it really is just from Hobart to Park Street.
Yes.
And it's a little bit of a historic one, that it's the one kind of node of medium density residential zoned land that's given really close proximity to the town centre, and has also always had, for quite some time, has historically had a lower parking rate than our suburb.
For
that reason, so that's why there's a bit of an anomaly,
so,
but yeah, thank you for that. I haven't picked up on it in the decision version.
No, so that's
the
maps. Right, so we should just make a note then that should be adjusted in the provisions.
Just trying to think where to start. Were you interested in understanding this debate about whether about how tourism operators sit in that definition?
Yeah, how they sit in that definition. And you also made a comment that if the relief was granted, some rule that would have quite serious implications for the construction of the rules, or even for the application of some of the rules, which would be clear how that happens.
It's suggested that we create a, or what was suggested is creating an additional rule within the rural zone. So the rural zone currently regulates the surface of water and commercial boating operations. And it's a full discretionary consent to undertake commercial boating within that area under the decision version, and that's historically been the case for a long time. And the intention with this was to add another category of activity, if you like, which is the public water ferry service, which would be distinguishable from other commercial boating, and it would be a restricted discretionary activity rather than a full discretionary activity. And it would have, I guess, the comfort of the objectives and policies that support public transport network being established, and that would give it some prominence or whatever relative to your other commercial boating activity, and it was afforded a lesser activity status, if you like, and some supporting objectives and policies. There are there's quite a list of discretion that we've restricted our discretion to, so we need to have a think how much different these two kind of categories of boating activity are, but certainly the intention is that the public water ferry services have an easier consenting path and given some sort of primacy because of this whole public good issue around trying to establish a public transport network that is efficient and all the rest of it. The importance of the definition that council's promoted and I support, as opposed to the one that's in the LTMA that Mr. Farrell was discussing, is that we've purposely, the definition of the PDP purposely excludes operators that are for primarily or solely for the purpose of tourism, transporting tourists.
So that's the point of differentiation?
That's the point of
difference. Not whether they're publicly owned.
No, we didn't go that far, that's right. So the word public, I don't know whether submitters have misconstrued that as meaning it needs to be publicly operated, publicly owned, whatever. We haven't gone that far. We've decided we weren't able to go that far just yet because we haven't got the detailed business cases being done as we speak in terms of this whole issue of water-based transport in Queenstown. And so until that's done, we felt there was just too much uncertainty to be talking about a public water ferry service that's actually subsidised by the regional council and operated in this, you know, in that manner. So we haven't been able to go that far, but what we have done is excluded those tourism operators that, granted, they are available to the public, we can all go on them wherever we like, but they are primarily and solely for tourism, and therefore, in my view, they don't, they're unlikely to meet or contribute significantly to the objectives in terms of public transport.
Now, this is a bit where me being a bit slow to the uptake at this stage, is that if they were included, as some of them have asked for, say the insults included, you've indicated there could be significant implications of that now. That's what I want to understand.
Well, my understanding is then they would be able to skip the rule, which I haven't got the whole rule done in front of me, but they would skip the rule that talks about commercial boating activity, and they would go to this rule, public water ferry service.
And
they would meet the definition, and they would be restricted discretionary, and arguably they would be able to, I guess, hinge some of their arguments around the fact that they are consistent with the objectives and policies in the transport section, because they're contributing to the overall transport network.
What would be the problem with the industry having a restricted discretionary consent with those matters of discretion as opposed to a discretionary, and I presume it's got a consent moment that lasts for some amount of time.
Yeah, presumably, and never let it lapse or anything else, that's right. So, I wasn't involved in the rural zone hearing, and I can probably come back to you.
I
can assume, and I haven't gone back and read that decision, I don't think, or it's not in the last few weeks, but I can only assume that it was well fought and the decision was made that full discretionary was the appropriate status for commercial boating.
Well, yes, but that was within the realms of what was in front of the panel at the time, and ferry services were not.
Mm.
That is the issue that's new, and all I can understand from the definition that makes a ferry service different is it has a regular schedule.
And so
it's not like shot over jet or Carrara jet, because they don't have a regular schedule. They go when the boat's full. But the Unicorn does have a regular schedule. And you can walk down there and you can see when it leaves.
Yeah.
How many other commercial operators actually operate to a regular schedule?
And are available for to just walk on.
Yes.
Shot over jet, it does.
Which one, sorry?
Shot over jet. I mean, it goes at a particular time, I'm sure, every 20
minutes.
Yes,
but does it go to more than one place? They go, you can't take shot over jet to Tucker Beach, can you, and get off.
Oh, so you're saying, is there anything else that takes you to a destination?
A ferry requires that there is a point of departure, a point of arrival, and it's different from the point of departure.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the definition needs a little bit more work to make that clear. But isn't, if you think of it in that sense, and I'm just trying to think, Real Journey is the only real people who are concerned about this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only the UNSCOR that arguably.
They own a lot of the others now, though.
Yes, but the others wouldn't fit into the category of operating a ferry service that goes from
Queenstown to Texas, I suppose, which has got its own submission but now is owned by.
Yes, but if Queenstown Water Taxis was operating to the Hilton Hotel into the centre on a regular service, that would satisfy this definition, wouldn't it? And in fact, it's intended for that sort of. It doesn't matter who the operator is, does it?
No.
Because I know that Remarkable's Party got submissions too on this, because I think they want one coming down the river somewhere. But all of us are trying to get a handle on what it is. The fact that tourists won't use the boat, well, that's axiomatic. We're in a tourist town. Most of the passengers are going to be tourists, except in commuter routes, perhaps.
I guess that's what we're worrying us, the mischief that could flow from that.
Mm.
People say, oh, well, you know, Now, the bus has potential tourists as well. You can get that kind of thing, and the council gets tied in knots about arguments as to whether it's a tourist service or not.
Mm.
I think that we had some reservations about that.
Mm.
Mainly, I'm probably raising this for the benefit of the council, really, because it could end up being on the receiving end of all sorts of argument and litigation that you don't otherwise want.
Yeah, I guess that's, I think it's worth thinking further on. I mean, in my mind, the Innslaw is different. It's 90% tourists as opposed to 50% or 40%.
But what would be the nuisance that would occur if the Innslaw could use the restrictive discretionary activity on the basis that they operate three times a day to and from Walker Peak, and that the general public can catch that for $1.50 or $10 or whatever it is?
I guess that's the issue. The definition doesn't cover anything about affordability or...
No, but it doesn't matter how much it costs, but it's that the general public can actually take that vote.
Yes, I mean, I'd have to have a look at the...
What the
arguments were in terms of the, through the rural, if there were any through the rural hearing in respect of safety or navigation, anything we're not covering here. For me, it's just not, it's not adding to the effectiveness of the method in terms of achieving the objectives and policies. It's a whole different thing. I can't see how it.
Sounds like this might be something that's worth reflecting on, in light of the rural provisions and the appropriateness of discretionary versus RD in these two competing chapters.
They'll both be in the same chapter.
This is a variation to rural and to the town, Queenstown town centre, because
that
has a bit of water.
I think all of us are just trying to understand what it is. We can understand ferry service, I've been on the ferry service in Sydney, for example, as a tourist going out to mainland and back. And in the commuter hours, it's definitely full of locals, but in the off-peak hours, a lot of tourists use those ferries. And so the question is, how are you going to make the distinction and why is it, do you want to make the distinction? That's the question. If navigation and safety is an issue, navigation is a safety issue, whether it's a public ferry service or any other commercial service.
Yes, I think if it's a scarce resource, though, the lake, the intentions to give public ferry services some primacy over.
Well, then it should say that, but, but it doesn't.
Schedule versus
other
commercial operators?
Well, there's the other fixed schedule operation which might provide a ferry service. And it may be the definition that's the problem.
I think that's probably right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
I don't think we're anticipating the Shuttle Jet's regularity of being a ferry service.
No.
Maybe other activities or something more
akin to the Innslaw. Yes, I mean, there's the other one that a couple of days ago, the Mountain Across Station, might be able to argue the same thing. But it may be that there's a requirement for a ferry service to be actually providing a public transport of commuters or something like that.
Mm.
Well, that's the question. I mean, that's where you've got the distinction between Shotover, where they pick you up and they drop you off at the same spot.
Mm.
Yes.
That's right.
Versus transport to a different location to then return. Whether that captures public transport or whether that is purely for tourism purposes is the question. Okay.
It's more about scheduling and destinations, I think, than about tourism per se.
Yeah,
maybe that they do operate in commuter hours, for example.
Mm.
Yeah, operating the hours that are appropriate for working population or something like that.
Yeah, and the schedule's not just regular time-wise, but it's from A to B and B to A, sort of on regular location.
But maybe a frequency issue too.
Just follow on from that, I suppose it's open, inviting you to comment further if you wish. You'll recall the question I was asking Mr. Crosswell about reducing the minimum parking rates. And I guess we're probably sold on the central Queenstown issue. We understand why and what the philosophy behind that is and where it comes from. I guess our concern is how applicable that is in industrial and business mixed-use zones in the environment that we have in places like Wanaka, Glenda Drive, those sort of places where there may not be a frequent public transport service,
yeah.
May not be practical within the foreseeable future, and the Act talks about the least in the foreseeable means. And I guess that's where the concern was coming from,
about having
basically taking away your ability to regulate that by saying let's lower the standards without any compensating provision to be able to say, put up a case. See how it stacks up.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so yeah, I've got a few comments I can make about that. So I guess one thing perhaps to bear in mind is that the industrial zone is not part of this, is not, this chapter doesn't apply to industrial zones, because industrial zones are stage three, I think. And so Glenda Drive, for example, will not, at the moment, it will not be. This doesn't apply to Glenda Drive, which is industrially zoned, but it does apply to, and at the moment it doesn't apply to Industrial Place either, but it does apply to, for example, the simplest example to give, I guess, is the right-hand side of Ford Road as you're going out of town, and the rest present Wanaka area of business mixed use. In those areas, I would say that, so residential has reduced significantly from what it was in the ODP in those zones, so it's gone from 2 per unit to 0.7 for a unit up to 3 bedrooms, and it goes up from there. And that is in part due to the fact that particularly Gorge Road is foreseen as being an area for more affordable housing, potentially worker type housing. It's part of the council's SHA. That has down in that area. So there were some reasons, and of course it was in the Group 1 zones that Mark Cagney suggested, and for all the reasons that it can withstand a lower parking rate. In terms of other activities that might occur in that business mixed use zone, like industrial, commercial and so on, they haven't actually been reduced significantly. Commercial / retail hasn't been reduced from the ODP at all. Industrial is a bit more complicated. The rate has halved from what we require on the ODP. I'm only sort of going into this detail because Commissioner Dawson was sort of asking about that. So industrial has halved, but service, if you look at the definitions and so on, service activities and industrial are all sort of, the definitions all sort of overlap in that. And so on. So I essentially combined the two as industrial, because I know from experience that people simply choose service because it's got a lower parking rate. So made service and industrial 1 per 50 square metres, 1 car park per 50 square metres, whereas in the operative district plan, industrial is 1 per 25 square metres. But we have other industrial zones here that are 1 per 40, 1 per 33. So in my view, looking at everything I can see, and also comparing with Christchurch and Nelson and Auckland City and others, decided that 1 per 50 was reasonable and not vastly different to what we have currently. So there's that, just to sort of cover that off. The other point I think to mention is that what you see there in, say, Industrial Place is, from research I've done in that area as part of this project is a function of a lot of parking dispensations having been granted. So cumulatively, that's, you know, that plus the fact that there's been reuse and change of use within buildings, and that hasn't been picked up through any sort of, you know, anything. Through no fault of anyone's really, these things just happen, and it's still an industrial activity, and they don't necessarily need consent, and, you know, life goes on, but the activity within that, those concrete panels, changes, and they need more parking, and these things morph over years, and the examples that I looked at, that was certainly a really a contributing factor, and particularly when it came to repair, motor repair type of operations, they were seemed to be operating well outside or beyond what they should be, and I did look seriously at increasing their parking rates that they required from the ODP based on comments I had for monitoring, etc. When I looked, the car parking rates are actually really high, it's just that they seem to be operating beyond, you know, I don't know whether they're using work bays, you know, we're using car parking as work bays or what's happening, but yeah, that was the case. We looked at how much parking was actually on site versus, in theory, how much should be on site. So I think what you see here is it's not necessarily a function that the rates are wrong, but that they haven't necessarily always been provided.
And without me wishing to be, I'm not trying to be critical, Mr. Crosswell, the way it was written, it gave the impression it sounded very Copenhagen-ish, if I could put it that way. And that's how it came across. It gave the impression that, you know, the minimum parking rates were sort of, you know, passe sort of concept, which should be phased out. And that might well be right in central Queensland. I'm going to be convinced of that.
Yeah.
What I was worried about was applying those sort of concepts in the Queenstown Lakes District scenario, taking account of what's actually already there.
Mm. Well, I think, yeah, like Mr. Crosswell said, we got that high level technical input and lots of best practice and what's happening in the world and those things, and then we did go through a process of deciding how far could we push this in our context, given no public transport in Waikato, the infancy of our public transport here, you know, those sorts of things. So, you know, as you read through it, whereas your Markeetney could go all the way down to nil for some activities in some zones, you know, we haven't gone that far in most of them. So that's that sensitivity checking to the local context, yeah.
But I do notice here, like policy 29.2.2.5, so basically that enable a reduction of minimum number of car parking spaces required only where, so it's quite clear, there will be a positive road minor adversities on the functional Australian transport network and the amenities of Australian environment, etc. So still taken care of. But there have been some liberalisations above, notably in 29.2.2.3, for example, and it's now common to make reference to proximity to bus routes. But I think one of my colleagues may have mentioned, unless you've got a very frequent top class public transport service, which you typically find in big European cities, for example, may not make, I've acted for developers who've come along and said, well, there's a bus route 500 metres over there, so we don't need to provide staff car parking. We know full damn well that their staff are going to drive to work. It's that kind of problem. You have to be a bit careful about policy form.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding when questioning all of the above is that given our system is every 15 minutes and it's proven to be really quite regular and reliable and so on, the advice I had from MRKG was that was sufficient to justify, you know, some of these shifts. Anything less than 15 minutes would not be, you know, if you have to wait 30, 40 minutes, it might come, it might not. That's, you're right, that's not going to work. From what I was being told, the system we have right now, where it does go, you know, within that sort of close proximity to the property, is sufficient to encourage one to get on it.
The only other question I have at the moment is, this is, well, a discrete matter, it's in paragraph 9.24, and it relates to the issue of overhanging buildings or roads. Now, I would have thought that may not be a problem, because the council, if you've got a building overhanging a road, it's still the council's land, and you need its consent of land. So is it really a problem?
Depends on the size of the truck that goes through the building. Might not be overhanging low.
Yeah, I mean, my experience of the licence to occupy Sorry, I couldn't find the paragraph you're referring to.
It's also in the wrong one.
Into the evidence room.
Yeah, in my experience in terms of the license to occupy process, it's, I guess one could argue it's more efficient, so it's not particularly, and it's not, I mean, it's just not as it's not comprehensive to the point that the council would ordinarily, yeah, probably consider either the design aspects or the aspects in terms of how, well, I mean, yeah, you could do that if the council's systems changed and they were instructed to consider and have the expertise involved through the licence to occupy process to look at things like ensuring it didn't interfere with the public transport network, like buses pulling up or the cycleway or the pedestrian, and also could get input into the urban design of the building just to check that it was...
I'm not sure what other councils do, but one would have thought that would be almost the first thing they'd look at. Because it's a case of the public criticise this, so the old council is making out the fact that the bus would collide with the veranda, where it seems to be that the license plate was one of the very first things that were considerably very basic things like that.
The, yeah, the roading issues, and usually it's parks and reserves that are involved in roading for engineers, but not necessarily the planning aspect of the design side of things.
Is it more concerned that most of those issues are like arise in the town centre zone where there are strong urban design criteria?
Probably, and from my experience in the operative district plan, that issue's just always been looked at as part of the application, even though in reality one could argue that the council hasn't got the ability to consider the facade and the veranda that's overhanging council unzoned land or designated land because it's not actually within the town centre. It's always been dealt with, but actually, in reality, it's really not. Yeah, it actually probably doesn't require consent at all. Whereas when that's a special area of the special character areas and all the rest, it would be good to close that. That loop up was my thinking.
Sorry, there was one other thing I did want to ask, and it relates to policy 29, a wording issue, 29.2.2.3, it says, require less accessory parking to be provided for residential places. As it's worded, you sort of immediately ask, what does less mean? Less relative to what? I'm just wondering whether it's something that's sort of hanging in the air there without being attached to it.
Yeah.
On the fourth line, it's such a long sentence, you're going to lose it. It sort of says compete with other items.
Yes.
So it's quite...
just might need a bit of reworking.
It's a long, long sentence.
Things change. And it may be that it's not necessary to all of it. It's really just clarifying that residential flats in areas such as low-density rear zone can have less car parking than its primary dwelling that's associated with, and
so I'm just thinking of a processing planner at some stage in the future might misunderstand or misconstrue what that actually what the best means in that context.
Just in terms of your comment, Commissioner Rixon, on what other councils do. I know in Auckland, in relation to verandas and other types of street furniture or projections across the road reserve, there are approaches meant to regulate through bylaws, where if that type of extension to a building is sought, approval is required from council or from transport or other such instances. So that's the way that they have regulated. I can't speak for other councils at this stage, but maybe something that we can pick up in our reply as well.
Questions of Mr. Smith about the use of the code of practice. And I think he helped me get my head around it. In the subdivision chapter, it's not the whole code might be relevant, but it's not incorporated by reference. And because subdivisions mostly require a resource consent application, like all of them, then it can be just referred to in the assessment matters. And presumably it's used a lot in subdivision. But in this chapter, because we've got activities that are permitted and we've got standards that relate to permitted activities for vehicle access and associated roading works, we need to have more precise standards. And is that the reason that the relevant parts of the code of practice have been incorporated by reference?
That's right. I mean, the advice from the council's engineering team was that they were comfortable with, in terms of the subdivision side of things, where it's using the whole code of practice in terms of the three waters and the roading and transport. You know, they felt it was appropriate. It was a guiding document, and it was used as part of your control sort of discretionary sort of process that you went through. But in terms of the transport section, it was felt that the code of practice actually includes a prescriptive table, for example, which is where I drilled down to actually what was the key part of this code of practice that people were telling me needed to be in the district plan, and it was this, you know, sort of whether it was 10 or 12 page long kind of table of minimum access widths, minimum gradients, the way that, you know, movement needed to occur through that corridor, those sorts of things, and everyone, including Stantec and council's own, you know, council's own engineers, felt that provided a good baseline that from which you could then depart from, and then you would use the code of practice to work through the AusRoads and all the other standards to decide what alternatives might also absolutely be appropriate. But we felt that the table provided as good a line in the sand as anything in terms of giving people some guidance, and the council's admin planners agreed that they wanted some guidance so that people could walk away and know that their accessway had to be 6 metres wide with a passing bay every 50 metres, whatever it might be, so that people weren't just, you know, had no guidance at all in terms of that. So that was the thinking and the difference in approach, yeah.
And the people, the council and yourself, happy that it doesn't change so frequently or need to be adapted and updated so frequently that having it incorporated by reference is a problem?
Well, I think, yes, I think, I mean, it has changed. I think it was a 2015 and 2018. So I mean, it sort of has been every 3 to 5 years previously. But that table, as I think Mr. Smith said, that table, Ms. Wakefield, that table hasn't changed between the last two iterations. So I can only assume that it wouldn't, you know. And I don't know that it won't change. And I guess the alternative is to either not have rules about minimum access widths and road widths and so on at all, or to include those 12 pages in the district plan itself, which we're back to square one again in terms of needing a plan change if it was, you know, if council practice was to change. So I don't think we can get around that it is a bit of a moving, you know, the whole discipline's moving quite fast, it seems.
We just have to live with that, and you've restricted it to the things that are essential for this chapter, and they don't seem to be changing as much.
No, they don't seem to be changing, and the reason for restricting it was a planning reason rather than the engineers would like to have the whole thing kind of incorporated and as part of the rule, but a lot of it is non-prescriptive, and, you know, this could work, or you might want to look at the appendices and, you know, be part of the role. So that's one of the main reasons of just getting it right down to that table.
Okay. Oh, that's good. Thank you very much for clarifying that. I've got a question about a couple of questions about the HDGA. I just have a little sort of nervousness about this exemption for previous ITAs and for all 29/4/10.
Yeah.
Because people have said, oh, you know, we've had a previous ITA, and we've got all these provisions already included. We shouldn't have to go through it again. But this, again, we've just been talking about being precise and having no discretion with the vehicle access standards and the code of practice. And now we've got, this is a standard in the new A that's been added in that talks about the land uses being the same, similar or less in character, intensity and scale to existing resource consent or district plan provisions that were approved on the basis of an integrated transport assessment. I mean, do you think that's really sufficiently certain and lacking in the need to apply discretion for it to be a standard?
Doesn't
seem it to me.
No, I mean, I was a little concerned. I have to admit that I was more comfortable with it because I know it's similar, if not the same, similar, I think, wording to any Auckland unitary plan.
I know, but...
Which, of course, made me think, well...
good enough,
they think it's certain enough. It's something I can certainly reconsider. I like the idea of it for the efficiency side of things, and that if a full, ITA has been done and the resource consent is complete. I mean, maybe that's the risk. It's just that if it's been done and you are completely consistent with it, then you're exempt. But if there is...
Could you make it more precise?
Yeah.
Simply saying that the trip generation and transport effects are no greater than those...
Well, yes, the word similar is pretty...
But if you're saying no greater than existing consent, then it's only the greater ones that you are concerned about, isn't it?
Greater or different in
characteristics and scale. We've got evidence that it's not just about the numbers, it's about the characteristics and when they occur at one part of the day.
Yeah.
I mean, I even saying where the effects are greater than something else requires an exercise of discretion, which isn't normally incorporated in a rule.
Yeah, and that's right, and I'm so sure I've defined other people's suggestions and reasons. Where I come from is exactly where you're coming from as well.
I think I said why you've got it, but
I've got concerns,
about this.
Isn't it really a matter of discretion?
Yes.
That they have to.
Well, yes, and that's how it
is. Consent, but it may be granted if they've already.
And I think that's where my previous 42A problem was at, where I was saying, well, it's not, essentially, even if you've done one, this might just be a redraft of that, a review, add some additional detail to what has already been done at the zoning stage and then resubmitting it. I felt that was not terribly arduous.
Yeah.
But I kind of thought, maybe it was duplication. So I can... point of view,
I know there'll be complaints about paying unnecessary consenting fees, but that's an administrative issue that we can't fix.
Well, it's 50 houses or 100
room
hotel.
And they're often, I think we've heard.
And they'll need consent anyway.
That's why I've heard that over and over at the end. It's almost not very arduous because they're going to have a consent anyway. And this is just, I think, it's bolted on to the other.
I think you would have read that's in part because transport's been done separately from land use. We haven't had that requirement in some of that land use aspect of things, and so now if we go through and review the plan, there is this gap through it, and that's why we need to plug it.
Yes, but often it's alongside another consent. It's not the only consent that would be required. The council could give exemptions for extra fees when there are two consents.
Well, I mean, it all rolls in, it's right.
Yeah. But, okay, so I think, all right, well, if you could think about that and maybe at some point clarify what your position is. Now, there was the other one that I asked Mr. Crosswell about, I think was about the airport zone. In your evidence, you have, again, mainly for similar reasons, recommended that the airport zone still be covered by the high traffic generating rules.
Mm.
Can you just run over your reasoning for that?
Yeah, I do take on board everything and agree with what Mr. Croswell said in terms of it being, you know, designated and anything that's not airport activity or airport related activity is subject to discretionary consent anyway. And that is one area where it does, the rules do drill down quite well into the transport effects better than in some other zones. But then, yeah, there just is the fact that zone is not entirely settled yet, from what I understand, and I haven't been integrally involved in this, so I'm going off what I've learned from council's policy manager, etc. So there's the appeal where they're seeking that visitor accommodation also be included in the airport-related activity, which Mr. Croswell talked about with you. And in that respect, yeah, if that's the only issue, then I would think that we could have a rule that exempt airport-related activity other than visitor accommodation, whatever it might say. You know, if we did feel that all other airport-related activity was actually didn't require the HDGA rule. But then there are, from what I understand, some other areas, you know, that are unknown in terms of the airport zone at the moment. So I'll list them there, that they've appealed the extent of the airport zone. That the airport zone includes land that's not within the designation, so we can't rely on the designation or outline plan approval process to deal with those handful of sites along Lucas Place who may wish to do something that's, you know, let's say it was visitor accommodation or even potentially even some of the things that are within airport related activity. You know, I'm a bit nervous, you know, and it's sort of, you know, education facilities provided they, you know, are related to the airport, and there's the retail and commercial services and industrial, as long as they're related to the airport. So it sounds good, but I'm just a bit like, particularly those areas that aren't within the control of the Queensland Airport Corporation or under the banner of the designation. The area that's covered by the designation as well, I guess the rules are, you know, potentially redundant.
Well, not if they're undertaken by a third party, which is the reason the zone's there.
And that's, and the fact that's right, that the zone goes beyond the designation as well, so it's sort of the same, same thing. So those are just some nagging concerns that I had. Regulating the transport effects of non-airport related activity through, and that's just sort of saying that if we were to regulate it through chapter 17, that would be inconsistent with the fact that all other large scale developments transport effects are dealt with through chapter 29. So this would be the only zone that deals with requesting an ITA and things like that through the zone provisions. So that's an administrative issue, but it's just one in terms of streamlining where someone wants to look to find out if they need to do a full transport assessment.
Where does that leave us though, in terms of we can only consider the decisions version of the plan, albeit subject to appeal. We can't consider what might happen in the Environment Court, and the Environment Court won't be hearing and dealing with this before we make our decisions or recommendations to the council. So,
no, it's mediated or something.
Can we take into account the uncertainty?
As
a result of the fact that there are appeals.
Well,
in terms of the range of activities, the extent of the.
It's probably what I'm getting at there, that there's some uncertainty around that decision making at this time, in my view. Or we have rules that factor in the possibility of visitor accommodation in the rule, which may end up not making a lot of sense to people, but that's,
Or is it that comment? Or is it just that there's no particular reason to make that different from the rest of the zones in the district?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I have to defer to Mr. Croswell's evidence on that front, I guess, being more the expert than I in terms of the HDGAs, and he feels that there are some merit in.
I thought it's the biggest trap that you've ever in Queenstown.
Yes. Well, I mentioned, I think, in my 42A that I quite agree with Mr. Kyle that it doesn't generate traffic. I must misunderstand what he's meaning by that. I don't know. It's probably just a misunderstanding.
We'll discuss that with Mr. Kyle.
Yeah. So, my view, it obviously creates a lot of traffic, but it. As I say, I need to defer to Mr. Crosswell on that one in terms of just why and how it's different in that respect. But I think a lot of his view as well was that airport-related activity is limited, and it's council, it's QAC, and council's going to be an advocate for good management of all these matters, urban design, which include transport. There's some other methods around it. Those were the reasons I went to from his evidence.
But where you've got to in your evidence is that there are, even if we don't know what the outcome's going to be, you can't prejudge the outcome from the appeals. There are uncertainties about the range of activities, this extent of the zone, whether it covers third-party land, outside the designation, and given that we don't really understand the full range of activities that they're traffic generating effects, it would be premature to exempt this zone from the high traffic generating activity rules. Is that what you're saying?
Yes,
but much more succinctly than I thought.
Okay.
Record that.
Premature. I think it's that, that's right, Ange. So I'm not convinced that it should be exempt at this point.
Yeah, no, I guess because I wasn't involved, I didn't have an understanding about the overlapping zone designation, the areas and extents, but you've explained that well to me. Thank you very much. Got more little questions. This is just in your main evidence, you talk about the fact that some of these definitions have been removed.
Oh, yeah.
And the parking requirements rely on definitions that aren't there anymore. I mean, is there any thoughts about that, any solution? I mean, are you suggesting that clause 16 changes needed to bring some of those definitions back in again?
Mm.
I don't know, do they relate to what you said they were,
industrial?
Well, no, that's there. It was,
backpackers,
1261 of your main definitions.
Yeah, I am suggesting.
Place of assembly, place of entertainment, backpackers are all still in place. They're all on the list of definitions. I mean, in the list of parking requirements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question I had on the same issue, Ms. Jones, was that the Section 32 report suggests that they should be included by variation.
Yeah, the variation, or if there
were
submissions, or...
Yeah, so I'm just wondering how you can jump from that to clause 16.2, and whether, in fact, clause 16.2 is really available. Is it a minor amendment of no substantive effect?
Well, I mean, the rules are there, and...
Well, the rules are there, but the definition of the term isn't there.
No, so you're then left to...
And then there's a question
to consider the common
question as to whether the definition needs to be there for clarification of the rule.
And the other point that I have to make is the definition was removed on the advice of the council reporting officer.
They were removed, yes, they were, but on the basis because those terms didn't appear in the district plan at all. And it didn't appear in the district plan at all because transport wasn't part of stage one.
Yeah.
So they got taken
officers
out.
Officers were talking to each other.
Well, this hadn't been... We were, but you were busy working at that point on decision drafting. So it was it was just a timing issue that this wasn't commenced until after... Yeah, and you're right, when the 42A was being drafted for definitions, it wasn't thought about that it might be needed, and they would be needed in a subsequent stage.
Mm.
And I couldn't put them into my notified version.
But that's what non-substantive when the council recommended to the hearing panel they be removed.
It might be something.
The rule,
yes.
Sorry. The rule was in the section 40. The rule was in the notified version, and the terms are there, but they're just not defined.
Yes, I know. I think you're right.
It sounds like it might be something that legal responds to submissions.
Mm.
It's one of the curiosities of a staged approach to a PDP. It's
really difficult because it's thrown up.
But I certainly understand your concern in relation to the use of 416, and that's something that we might be best addressing legal submissions.
We have been reasonably liberal with it, but we've been quite specifically on non-substantive things.
Mm.
Where they would be unlikely to see, to a likelihood that someone lodging a submission. I can't think that definitions are going to be ignored when they affect parking standards.
I completely understand that it's a case of providing ourselves with some comfort that the use of clause 16 here wouldn't be something that would cause any. I also understand that the use of clause 16 has been vastly more liberal by other councils in certain situations, but we need to make sure the approach is correct here.
Mm.
In the light of the fact that there has been a decision here, and then we're now proposing to bring it back.
And other councils, in my experience, are not in such a litigious environment as this council.
Mm.
Except perhaps Auckland Council.
I think that's a point well made. Auckland was also quite different, operating under quite limited restrictions for appeals, so that's another flavour to
it. Yes, they have a real advantage.
Christchurch is even more
important.
But here the full ambit of challenge is available to all submitters, so no, I appreciate your sentiments there.
Mm.
Just one further question, and it's just, can you, where an activity is not listed in the parking requirements table, is there a rule that sort of is a catch-all for those?
Yeah, it's discretionary.
Oh, okay. So is that in the activities list?
Not in the standards.
I thought there must be, but
yes, there is, and it is discretionary. Why those submitters can't
parking for any activity not listed in table 29. Okay, so if you have something that's not listed there, such as a staffed utility, is what I was thinking.
Yes.
It would get people, rather than trying to list everything, that's caught by this discretionary.
Yeah.
So
there is
it's 29.4.11. So, if you're an activity that hasn't got a parking requirement at all, even if your activity is permitted in your zone, you have to make a discretionary activity application for your parking.
Well, for the activity.
For breaching, under this rule, for a breach of the car park.
But a discretionary activity, everything's open.
Parking,
okay.
Yes. It's quite. So you could.
Yeah,
the activity listed in this set of activities is actually the activity of parking.
Yeah.
Parking for an activity not listed in the parking table.
But of course you have to consider everything.
It opens it up.
It does. It's got like making it non-compliant.
Yeah,
consider that, see what submissions. And that is not this an excuse or anything else for anything, but so that's the same as what's always been the operative plan. It's a rollover approach in that respect, but it's not satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, do you know if it's ever been used?
I don't know. I've not either used it in the process.
Probably the activities that haven't been thought of would be non-compliant or discretionary.
But right. I mean, that may well be that they make some form of application.
Yeah, I mean, with the utilities, I would have thought a lot of those, I mean, they submitted and that's fine, but I thought a lot of those would be designated, designated land. Yeah, I don't know.
It
hasn't caused any problems.
It's been
a
more
cooperative
plan. Yeah, yeah. Someone's going to have a something like Rainbow's End, which I'm sure hasn't been listed, and that is not going to be anything other than discretionary along complying with any zone anyway.
Mm.
So
and, you know, arguably that would be a commercial activity.
I just wanted to make sure there was some fallback position. There is.
Yeah.
That's it, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, the good thing is I only have one, so we can hear it. Deal with that now. Page 27 of your section 42A report, in paragraph 19, you're talking about the process of what happened when a road is stopped. And says the proposed process then clarifies that the land is no longer subject to provisions that apply to roads and that instead the provisions from the adjoining zone apply from the date of stopping. How can that occur without going through the first scheduled process? Effectively you're rezoning the land, don't you?
We might have to come back to you on that because it is something I worked through with Sarah Scott.
What is the same as Christ?
Yes, I think it is.
Probably the same advice from the same law firm.
Christ would have to do a re-notification of this as well.
So I talked to her about that, and we were quite careful with wording and so on to ensure that it was appropriate.
I think it's legal advice that is appropriate, it would be quite good to have that provided to us. Because we raised this with Mr. Winchester in 2016, which is why it's changed.
The deeming side of things.
The deeming side, yes. But I want to make sure that the legal advice is included and available to us. I'm not sure if there's any submissions on it.
I think the Christchurch example might actually zone roads.
Yes,
and
it's
so
a
that
difference.
Was one of the problems. They have a problem on both sides because when a new road is created, it's suddenly given a new zone. I guess this is just the kind of converse of that.
There's the other difference that I've been involved in. The underlying zone was said to be the adjoining land, and if they were different, that they met in the middle of the road. It doesn't matter then if you stop the road, you're already in the zone. But now you're saying there's no zone, but if you stop the road, it was treated as if it's zoned.
It's the reverse of the approach to unzoned roads, in a way, is what you're trying to explain.
Well, yes, so what I'm saying, trying to get my head around is, you have no zone on a piece of land, 20 metres wide, running through, and it might be residential now, on one side, and it might be commercial on the other. Stop the road. Technically, you've still got a piece of unzoned land, but you're saying, by way of the rules, you're going to treat it as if it is zoned. And I'm just wondering how lawful that is, because effectively it's rezoning the land without using the first schedule process.
Understood.
The concern you're raising is the reason we haven't zoned roads as such.
I don't think there's any need to zone roads.
No.
But there should be an underlying zone, just like designation, have an underlying designation, an underlying zone. So
that's right. And they are relatively common provisions. And I know that in Auckland and the legacy plans, they all have rules relating to unzoned roads or unzoned land. And we are exactly, as you described, they're just met in the middle.
Yeah.
But I can't recall providing any advice on the lawfulness of that approach, but we...
I think there is
advice on this particular matter here.
I'm fairly sure that advice would have been given to Christchurch from your firm on a very similar arrangement. I mean, I think one of the things in Christchurch is that although the roads are zoned, that zone's not shown on the planning maps. So there are, there's no requirement to show it. The zone doesn't need to be there because it's on a planning map. It could be there by way of a law.
That's how this roads would make it clear that the map planning maps may not accurately reflect
the roads
at any given time.
Yes, I think that needs to be clear on the planning maps that an area that's shown as rural zone may actually have, or at least, I don't know, new residential zone or something, may actually have a road zone on it.
And if there are no submissions on that, that can just be in the reply.
That's right.
Yeah.
Do you know the submissions?
Submissions asking us to continue to use the OB process in terms of designations.
Well, I think the OB process is like lawful, so that's quite straightforward. The next thing is I just like to make sure that the new one is lawful.
Everybody.